Welcome to Ad Chatter, the podcast from adpulp.com.
Welcome to a special edition of Ad Chatter from adpulp.com. I'm Dan Goldgeier. Has the ad industry become too left-leaning in its politics? Have we lost touch with consumers who don't live in cosmopolitan cities? And has advertising forgotten how to sell products and services while at the same time replacing sales messages with social, environmental, and political agendas? They are controversial topics, and my guest today has a lot to say about them. Steve Harrison was European Creative Director of Ogilvy One and Global Creative Director of Wonderman. He was also the founder of his own agency, HTW, and in the 7 years he ran that agency, he won more Cannes Lions in his discipline than any creative director in the world. His work has been featured in the DNAD copybook. He has also authored Changing the World is the Only Fit Work for a Grown Man, his biography of Howard Gossage. Also, he's written How to Write Better Copy and How to Do Better Creative Work. But his latest book is the most provocative one yet. It's called Can't Sell, Won't Sell: Advertising, Politics, and Culture Wars, Why Adland Has Stopped Selling and Started Saving the World. Steve, welcome to Ad Chatter.
Thank you, Dan. It's a pleasure to see you again after all these years. And thank you for having the courage to run this talk. There's a lot of people in America who wouldn't go near me.
we'll get into that, because I think, like I said, this was one of the most provocative books about advertising that has been written in a long, long time. People have been talking about these issues in blogs and on some of the ad industry trades, but nobody's really taken it on the way you have, with a lot of research, a lot of footnotes, and essentially what, you know, as people would say, you brought the receipts. So what made you decide to write this book? Why now? And was there a triggering event that led to this?
It was triggered by an amazing statistic that an industry friend of mine called Patrick Collister. Paddy runs the Caples Awards now and edits a magazine called The Directory, which is well worth getting hold of. And he came up with a report on the Cannes Lions winners in 2019. And he said to me, I think it was, he analyzed the 26 Grand Prix winners, their entries, and he said that only six of them had an increase in sale as not only the main objective, but I think any objective at all, which got me to be thinking, well, have we lost the ability? And if you look at the work which we show as exemplary, do we really care about selling? And so I started to ponder, well, why would this be? And from my experience of the industry, I made a causal link between left-wing progressive politics, which predominate in the industry, and what I infer is an unwillingness, conscious or unconscious, to stoke the capitalist engine of growth and consumerism. And that was my kicking off point. So I went off in search of evidence to substantiate that. And I must admit that my first port of call were journals, Wall Street Journal and Forbes magazine, and Adland's response to Trump's victory in 2016. And there was a certain amount of concern, I think, after that victory, which took everybody on the eastern and western seaboard by surprise, it would appear. Could Adland relate to and empathize with the 60 million people who didn't agree with their politics?
Right, there was
That was my starting off point, you know, kind of. And then I thought, well, do we have the same problem here in the UK? And my God, I'm pretty damn sure we do.
Now, you're a veteran ad person. Has it always been this way? Or if you go back to when you got started, was there always a bit of a progressive bent, or is it just more tipped over in one favor on one side than?
Oh, I know. I remember. I'm old enough to remember what was a golden age of UK advertising, you know, the 1980s, 70s, 80s, 90s. And there was always a certain sniffiness about advertising, about selling and results and shifting product off shelves. You know, kind of, there was a certain, silk-hatted dilettante approach to it. But there was a general consensus within the industry that we had a morganatic relationship with the free market, you know, kind of, or to put it, you know, the analogy would be, we were like two mountaineers roped together, you know, and our progress up that slope was mutually beneficial, you know, kind of. So there was a general consensus. I mean, you've also got to realize that the most adventurous, the most audacious, exciting ad agency in London, and I would say the world in the 70s and 80s, Saatchi & Saatchi, engineered Margaret Thatcher's premiership. You know, they sat in number 10 Downing Street. So there was a, you know, while some people were left-wing, the Saatchi brothers were in bed with the Conservative Party, and a Conservative Party that is nowadays hated by the left. You know,
right,
that's the period of our politics.
You're referring to there was a famous ad that said "Labor isn't working." Was that
the one?
You know, I also remember in 1984, Hal Reiney from Hal Reiney and Partners in San Francisco. He went to work for Ronald Reagan, and the reelection campaign. A famous ad called "Morning in America." So yes, you can certainly argue that there's been a little bit of a shift like that. You know, political advertising is its own gargantuan beast, and that's another discussion for another time.
Can I answer your question as far as the shift is concerned? It was quite possible during the in the UK during Tony Blair's period for people who work in the advertising industry to do their own triangulation, you know, kind of whereby it was possible to work in the industry, but also possible to be a, you know, kind of an open Labour supporter, you know, kind of Tony Blair's economics were mixed economy. He was a social democrat, you know, he believed in the free market. We replaced Blair with Miliband, but then Jeremy Corbyn and Jeremy Corbyn is our Bernie Sanders.
Okay,
and so politics has shifted to the left, and it's now more, and I imagine it's the same thing in your country, that for people who are supporters of Sanders, it's very difficult now for you to reach that compromise, to say that I'm a supporter of this system, which, you know, Bernie and Jeremy Corbyn, you know, kind of said they wanted to dismantle. You know, so how do you meet up with the people who share your metropolitan bubble and explain that I'm working advertising still? And they're saying, well, my God, you know, kind of capitalist running dog. So you say, oh, shit, I'm no longer selling things. No, how 1980s? I'm saving the world.
Well, what's your reaction to the polls there? I see polls, I see surveys. They're conducted by organizations like Edelman and others, that they show a desire among consumers to support brands that reflect their personal and political values, or in the converse of that, stop using products that don't reflect their values. We keep hearing that this is a trend, and it's backed up by research, or is it?
I think you could cite, you know, kind of contrary polls that make the contrary argument, and I would point you in the direction. And again, it is only UK oriented, but Andrew Tenzer and Ian Murray of Reach Research, their latest white paper on advertising in the UK, the aspiration window, makes it very clear that how empty a promise that is. I mean, on the subject of values, look, Values serve, if someone says to you, will you buy a product that shares your values? Well, values function in society as a means of binding people together and make them feel like they belong. So of course I'm going to say, when someone surveys me, will I buy a product that shares my values? That's what values do. The good side of values is that it binds. The bad side of values is it causes prejudice. You know, kind of people who don't share my values is the root of racism and prejudice. This, you know, kind of, so yes, if I'm asked, well, would you support a politician who shares your values? Well, what kind of idiot would say no, you know, kind of, no, yeah. I wouldn't. In fact, I'm going in search of people who don't share my values.
Right, you know? Right. Now, you know, in the book, you dive deep into that and you talk about the idea of people who you call somewheres versus people who are anywheres. I wonder if you'd just talk a little bit about this idea and how it relates to the advertising work that's being produced these days.
Yeah, well, the division between the anywheres and the somewheres comes from David Goodhart's book, The Road to Somewhere. And I think it explains a hell of a lot, you know, kind of... he says that the anywheres, let's start with the anywheres, probably 20% of the population, but they dominate UK culture, UK industry, UK politics, you know, kind of, up until last December they did in the UK. So they have a dominant role in our culture and society and in business. And the anywheres, 20% of the population, they relate to, if you ask them where they're from, they will say, I'm from anywhere. They have a cosmopolitan, metropolitan lifestyle, which they're very comfortable with. They identify with the outside world. They're outward going. They're happy with their metropolitan persona. Okay. And they are generally, I would say, liberal humanitarian in their outlook. Okay. Progressive politics, whatever. The other side of that are the people who are from somewhere. And in the United Kingdom, that is something like 50% of the population. You know, 70% of the people in the UK still live in the same place as they did when they were 14. You know, kind of. So they're bound by the community in which they take their identity from the community in which they were brought up and in which they still live. And their identity is born through time, through generations, through heritage, through a sense of place and who I am. And I would say that they are conservative in social and cultural outlook. And whereas the liberal sees themselves as a humanitarian, the anywhere sees them is a communitarian, okay? And I would say that the anywhere likes people in general, but the somewhere likes people in particular.
So the way you frame it is that the advertising industry is full of people who are anywheres, much
My
more
God,
than
I mean, what are the networks about? But the networks inculcate in you a sense that you can work anywhere. You work for an anywhere company. You know, when I worked at Ogilvy's, we talked about synergy, Ogilvy orchestration, one agency divisible, that in all of the 145 offices worldwide, we were just one entity. So we looked outwards to the network. You know, we work for globalized companies. You know, kind of our outlook was metropolitan, cosmopolitan, international. You know, can you when you go to work for Ogilvy or you go to work for one of the big networks, you are no longer looking back to from where you came. If you came from a small town, you're looking out into the you're part of this homogenous international group, right?
Right. So, given that, would you say that we, and I just speaking of the advertising industry in general, we're speaking a lot of generalities today, but does that mean we are failing to communicate with the somewheres on behalf of our brands?
I would say so. I would say so. I think one of the we don't share the same values. I mean, to turn you to again to Andrew Tenser and Ian Murray's research on the that white paper, The Empathy Delusion. We, in tests devised by Daniel Kahneman and his team, our level of empathy is lower than that of the mainstream, which is amazing because we pride ourselves on our ability to empathize with our target audiences. You know, kind of we pride on ourselves to put aside our own personal preferences and prejudices and to see the world through the eyes of our target audience. But Tenser and Murray have blown the hole through that whole theory, I can assure you. But you've got to look at the way that the anywheres look at the somewheres, that the relationship between the anywheres and the somewheres, you know, you can see this in between the way that the cosmopolitan metropolitans view the flyover states. You know, kind of there is a certain amount of condescension and contempt inherent in the relationship between the anywheres and the perception of the somewheres by the anywheres. And I think that condescension and contempt is carried through into our working relationship when we're asked to communicate, reach out, empathize, and connect with these people. And I think we're finding it increasingly hard to, and I think we're actually, in many cases, we've given up.
Yeah, and I think it was Stan Richards, who runs the Richards Group, which is in Dallas, Texas. He wrote an article, and maybe it was in Ad Age or maybe it was in Ad Week, defending the his agency's ability to reach what we would call middle America because of where he is and the clients he has.
Yeah.
You know, so there are pockets of agencies in what you would call flyover country, yet still, you know, they tend to attract college educated, predominantly white, up until recently predominantly male talent. So I guess my question to you is, what does the ad industry need to do to get a better balance of talent entering the business all completely?
Just to go back to your other point, historically in the United States, your great agencies have come from the boonies, you know, and kind of like going back to Howard Gossage in San Francisco.
Which was the boonies back then.
from advertising backwaters, you know.
Yeah.
And if you look at O'Reilly and Gossage, you look at Portland, Oregon, you look at Crispin Porter, you look, you know, kind of Fallon McGilligan. Historically, the great stuff has come from not from New York.
That's a great point. Yep. The Martin Agency in Richmond, Virginia.
Absolutely.
Dallas. And it's very interesting. But, you know, now that those agencies have those reputations, worldwide reputations, they can pretty much bring the talent from anywhere in the world they want to. So once again, you get that sort of like-mindedness. But let me ask you this. You know, is this something that can be trained? Is it, you know, is agencies don't train people the way they used to? They want people hitting the ground running. They want young folks. You know, is this notion of empathizing with the somewhere somewheres, can it be trained? Can you train somebody to do that, or is it a fault of the recruitment process that we're just not getting the talent that we really need?
Well, I think you just said it, that even now, that those pockets of kind of provincial, away from in the flyover states, if the agencies do set up, they're still recruiting college and university educated middle class kids, you know. So now you're going to get less great Fallon McGilliguts. You're going to get less, and because I think that when you look back on your golden age, it coincided with the emergence of a lot of Jewish and Italian kids job in white collar jobs.
Yeah, you're talking about the DDB in the 60s.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, mm-hmm. and the occasional Greek guy, you know.
Before my time, Steve.
Yes. Well, before mine, but what I'm saying is that the advertising industry needs this constant flow of hungry, streetwise,
right,
kids to come in through. Okay, and let me give you some frightening statistics on the UK. That in the United Kingdom, right, 84% of our workforce is aged 18 to 40. Okay, nothing wrong with that, I suppose. But as far as diversity is concerned, it gives a lie to the claim that it is a diverse industry. But more importantly, 88% have got a degree or an MA in the UK. Yep. 88% of the kids who are of the people working in our industry have got a degree or an MA. Now, university education is still a signifier of class in our country.
Yeah, and it is here to an extent, too, because when you're talking about an industry like the ad industry, there have always been more people who want to get in the industry than there are jobs for those people in the industry. So how do those people find jobs? Connections, networks, people who know people, little nepotism. You know, there's a lot of that.
And that's the worst. That's the worst. Yeah. Let me give you another frightening statistic, though, that 70% of the people who work in our industry grew up where the chief income earner was social grade AB. That compares with 29% of the mainstream.
What is social grade AB? I'm not familiar.
No, that's the richest, the top end of society. You know, the highest income earners.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And finally, as far as our BAME, Black Asian mixed ethnicity colleagues, that's something like 69% of those we have working in the industry were privately educated.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So although we do have representation from BAME backgrounds, they're all middle class. You know, the national average is 7% were privately educated, but those with a BAME background, 69% were. So we're a middle class bubble, Dan. You know, it's a middle class bubble. And we talk about getting diversity in there. And I think that this plan to become diverse should be colorblind. You know, it's working class kids of all backgrounds who need to be allowed in. But you said that you mentioned the nepotism shield protector, and that I find is absolutely insidious. You know, that the middle classes are taking their kids in and allowing their, you know, giving their kids an easy ride in. Do you know someone? Can you get an internship? You know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, kind of, I get that asked all, you know, quite often, can you get me an internship? And I say, I can't even get myself an internship.
So let's get back a little bit more towards the notion of selling work and the current, you know, state of the work in the ad industry that reflects a lot of social and political agendas. How much of a role do the trade press, you know, Ad Week, Ad Age, Campaign, and award shows have, you know, what role have they played in promoting this work? And have the trade press and the award shows been detrimental in that sense?
Yeah, I think that again, it goes back to in about 2012, 2013, when, you know, kind of the whole purpose thing kicked off.
Brand purpose, yeah.
Yeah, social purpose thing kicked off. It really was a case of suddenly people who worked in advertising could find a reason to turn up. Our left-leaning progressive colleagues in advertising could find a reason to turn up every week, every day now. You know, kind of, and Campaign and Can gave them that reason with the white pencils at DNAB and the Chimera project at Can. So they get, so it was like, okay, you know, kind of like you can put all of your effort into work with purpose-driven strategies. They were categories on their own in those days. Mm-hmm. Now, as Adweek said last year, not, you know, kind of in 2019, where once there was a purpose category on its own, now everything has got to have a purpose. A lady called Carol Cohn, who is a pioneer of social impact campaigns, was covering Cannes for Fast Company magazine. And she reported, triumphantly, I imagine, that in 2019, in a large part, judges are prioritizing meaningful work. Judges from outdoor, entertainment, design, press, and PR juries all spoke about the importance of work that has a positive effect on the world. Okay, so the judges are actually distinguishing between ads with a purpose and ads without one. So if you're a creative person and you want to pick up a piece of shiny gold metal you know, kind of in June in on the Côte d'Azur, you're going to do something with a purpose in it. You know, kind of, you, if you know that it will enhance your prospects of winning, then you're going to start knocking them out. To the extent now, the absurd situation that you've got WARC, W-A-R-C, with their compilation of the most awarded agencies, the most awarded clients, the most awarded networks, of the 10 most awarded campaigns in 2019, five of them had a social purpose. One of them was for the New York Times about its impartiality, which anybody who lives west of Hoboken will tell you is absolute nonsense anyway. And the other one was for, what was it, Gringos or whatever? It was Dink, oh God, what was it? It was the one where they put on a Broadway show to tell you how shit advertising is.
I think it was Skittles. Was it Skittles?
That's it, Skittles.
Yes, Skittles, yeah, yeah. The candy, yes. I remember that, yes.
So only three of them essentially were aimed at getting somebody to get their credit card out of their pocket and buy something that somebody had made in a factory down, or buy somebody that somebody was hoping to sell them in a shop, you know, and which is the fundamentals of our economy. You know, or were before the COVID-19 crisis. And now there are no fundamentals.
We'll get to COVID-19 in a little bit, but what role does social media have in influencing brands to be more politically active and reactive to current events? I mean, I know from personal experience, a lot of folks who run both at agencies and at brands, they're on Twitter, they're on Facebook, they're on Instagram, and they're reacting to current events.
I think as much as anything, I think that I think that our industry is run by people who have one eye on their Twitter feed, on their Instagram feed for most of the day, you know, kind of, and a lot of them have built their personal brands as a result of their ability to sit on the right forums, to sit on, to be judges at Cannes, and to give the right politically correct awards out, and to comment on those awards, you know, in all earnest terms about how good this stuff is. And I think their personal brands are based upon their commitment to social justice causes. And so they are scared witless that they say something that causes a shitstorm on social media, because their social, their personal brand could be destroyed in an instant. Okay, so I think that it's more a case of we've always been blown hither and thither on the winds of fashion and hearsay. Okay, and I think that we are terrified that the Twitterati and the Digerati and will descend upon us and take us to task. You know, kind of, again, I don't think it's that social media necessarily reflects how mainstream America is thinking. You know, I think mainstream America is like just wishes everyone had shut up.
So that brings up a good point. You know, there are people in advertising, and now we're also seeing it in the Googles and the Amazons and the Facebooks of the world, that they're feeling, a lot of rank and file employees feel uncomfortable about working for certain accounts or promoting certain causes. You ran an ad agency for many years. Did you ever have a situation where a creative team or somebody in your organization came to you and said, I don't feel comfortable working on this brand, this product? Should advertising people be more vocal about what accounts they are and aren't willing to work on? You turned down a few things. I know that you wrote in the book that you had a policy of not taking on certain types of work. If I'm just a copywriter in an ad agency, should I speak up? Could I speak up?
In my shop, as you know, we wouldn't work on tobacco or gambling, which I don't think anyone should get any awards for, frankly. I mean, that's, we had a policy whereby we asked three questions about a piece of work. Can we do work we will all be proud of? Was the first question. And that had to be answered. Otherwise, we wouldn't ask the other two. The other two questions, can we make money and the client make money? And the third question, will we enjoy working on it? You know, will we have a good time? Mm-hmm. So we had to answer number one. If we couldn't answer number two about the money, then we'd say, can we enjoy it? Anyway, we'll do it for nothing. So, you know, kind of, so we'd do that. But number one always had to be answered. Mm-hmm. Now, if somebody came up to me and said, I don't like working on this account because the account, the client is rude to me, the client bulls me out, the client is upsetting me, then on two occasions, one of them Virgin Atlantic, and the other one, Granada Sky Broadcasting, two mm-hmm. big accounts. Yeah. You'll have heard about them in the States, I'm sure.
Of course.
We fired them. at cost to us, but, you know, and had great fun. Got very drunk. We said, I'm afraid to tell you, but we seem to have misplaced the Virgin Atlantic account.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of, so those were, you know, kind of, those were the limits we put upon that. If someone came up to me and said, I don't want to work on Shell, for example, if uh-huh. we didn't have a fossil fuel account,
right.
if someone came mm-hmm. up to me and said, I would have to weigh this in the balance. I mean, I've promised Shell when I took the business on that I would do my absolute utmost to keep his employees in gainful employment. Right, that's what
right,
I'm doing
yeah.
when I'm advertising.
Yeah.
You know, kind of. Well, I think it was Luke Sullivan said, when you're making an ad, you're building a factory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of. And so I would have to weigh the balance between. Well, I promised I'd do my best to keep your people in gainful employment, which is the pact you make with the client.
Right.
You know, and in order to do so, I therefore need to put my best people upon that work. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And therefore, I don't think I would tolerate somebody telling me that they didn't want to work on it, that they didn't care about the gainful employment that we were hoping to maintain for the people who were paying our wages as well.
Yep.
And I think I would say that despite the fact that I'd spent months, maybe years training you, and despite that I'd spent months, maybe years honing your talents and abilities, and giving you the benefits of working at my agency, I would say it's up to you. If you want to leave, you can leave.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, that also brings up an interesting point. You brought up the fossil fuel industry. Now, you wrote a book and you produced a documentary about Howard Gossage, a wonderful book. And he, of course, was famous in San Francisco. He worked for a couple of different accounts. He did both advertise gas stations, I think FINA was the name of it, as well as organizations that promoted conservation. Now, how did he manage to square these two, and can you do it concurrently?
I think that it's called being a professional, isn't it? You know, you're a pro. I mean, what are you? You're an advert. You you agree to take your client's business on. And you agree to do it to the best of your ability.
Right.
In Gossage's case, however, he quit. He stopped working on his commercial clients.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In about 1966, he stopped working for his commercial clients. As an ad man, he's carried on working for them in what he called Generalists Inc., which was his consultancy. But as far as Freeman, Mander and Gossage was concerned, he stopped working for it, and he put all of his time and effort into working for his non-profit cause-related work.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up, because we're seeing a lot of veteran ad people decide, I'm tired of shilling for corporations, I'm going to go try to do something good, I'm going to try to change the world. And I think when they're empowered, you know, when you're the boss or you run your own ship, or you're, you know, as Bill Birnbach said, a principal isn't a principal unless it until you cost you money. Then you have the full power. But we're also seeing, at the same time, we're seeing a lot of employees, like I said, rank and file employees, try to influence the kinds of accounts that their bosses are taking on. It's a generational conflict in some cases.
But aren't they letting their progressive left leaning views
influence
their choices and try and dictate to the advertising industry who and when it should work for?
Yeah.
And isn't this a form of cancellation, which is inimical to, you know, kind of the basic principles of freedom and choice.
Yeah. Well, one of the ideas in your book that you did praise was REI's opt outside idea. And that was, of course, encouraging people not to shop on Black Friday, which is in America, at least the day after Thanksgiving, usually the busiest shopping day of the year. Talk to me about why that idea resonates for you more than other brands promoting social causes when they do it.
Don't get me wrong, Dan. I think that if the purpose is in alignment with the product, the brand positioning, and the proposition you're making, then crack on.
Yeah.
You know, I have no problem at all. I mean, I quote that example. I quote BT's example in the UK. And I have, I have no problem as long as if it is ingrained into the company, then I'm cool with it.
Baked into the cake, as they say.
Yeah. And if enjoy the great outdoors and don't spoil it is that positioning, I think it's a great positioning.
Yeah.
You know, enjoy the great outdoors and keep it great. Yeah. It's a lovely sentiment.
They really caught lightning in a bottle with that idea, because I think it's so resonant with what they do. And REI is based out here, so I know some people who work there, and it's a fine company. So
I have no problem with that, but I'll give you what I do have a problem with is Cadbury, which is it's our Hershey bar, you know, kind of it. Cadbury Dairy Milk is
way better than Hershey's, let me tell you.
Is it? Oh, right.
British chocolate is always better than American chocolate, and there's no debate about that.
All right, okay, good. Well, it's because there's a pint and a half of full cream dairy milk goes into every bar of Cadbury's chocolate, which
and
I know
sugar.
Because they've been telling me for 45 years. They 12 months ago, they decided that Cadbury would get behind the cause of loneliness amongst the elderly. Mm-hmm. And they did a campaign, this is 12 months ago, in which they said, we will give our words. So they sent out empty, you know, kind of blank wrappers. And we said, we've given our words to help the aged, the elderly, help the charity that helps the aged. And will you get in touch with Help the Aged, the charity, and offer your services to get in touch with old people and help break through the loneliness problem. And admirable stuff came out of nowhere. They'd never talked about this before, but it was something that they launched with great fanfare. And that was in 2019. And what has happened since, Dan? The people to suffer most during the COVID-19 crisis are the old who are locked indoors with no family to come and visit them. No, you know, living in fear that this week may be their last. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of unable to use WhatsApp, unable to use the technology which we take for granted. You know, and where are Cadbury? Not a bloody word. Not a bloody word. They've given £100,000 to help the aged. That's all they've done. £100,000 on a company that it's in my book, but eye-watering amount of money they take in revenue and a trickle they pay in tax.
Right. So
that's what annoys me. That's the kind of stuff that annoys me.
Mm-hmm. So how can brands make sure their ad agencies are focused on selling products versus what you would say trying to change the world? Does it start with research? Is it the creative brief process? Where, you know, how does that start, and how can agencies stay on track?
I think an acceptance that it is their function to do so. That there are simple processes that will enable them to get back on track. There is a couple of marketing experts, economists, I think, in the United Kingdom called Peter Field and Les Binnett, who have been promoting the funnel. The funnel is the first marketing theory ever devised, I think, by a man, I think, called St. Elmo Lewis in about 1898. And the funnel is simply, you know, kind of you build a brand with long-term advertising and then the short-term advertising to do the activation and selling. You know, so the theory is quite simple, but people don't want to get in. People are, as I say, consciously or subconsciously unwilling to get on that. Okay, to buy into the fact that the end result of all of this will be somebody buying something.
So you published a version of this book in early March. And boy, that was some fortuitous timing, just as COVID-19 started spreading worldwide. So yes. you updated this book and you republished it last month. So what do you think, you added a little bit more to the book. What do you think has changed in the ad industry in the past 6 months? And going forward, do you see anything that'll be changed forever or new ways of doing business that'll be here to stay? Or are we going to, if we luckily find a vaccine sooner or later for this COVID, we're just going to snap back to the way we were?
I think that, I mean, I was hoping that the ad industry, I'm pretty tough on what Bob Hoffman calls, I repeat much of the, you know, Bob Hoffman's critique of the digital delusion in the first part of the book. Mm-hmm. And I roll back on that in the second part of the book, the chapter about COVID-19, because it is the digital and direct guys who really are, they haven't stopped working. They have not stopped working since, they haven't been furloughed, I can assure you. The guys, I don't know what it's like in the UK, in the US, but in the UK, my friend has never left his shed. He's a creative director at Abbott Mead Vickers, and he runs the digital and direct stuff. Yep. And he's not stopped working.
Yeah.
And you look at what Sir Martin's done. Sir Martin Sorrell has suddenly bounced back in a big way as Sir Martin, you know, kind of, he's never out of the papers in the UK talking up, you know, kind of S4 Capital and how well it's doing. It's making money. He's making money through Media Monks and through his programmatic stuff. He never mentions brand, right?
Yep.
And we are in great danger. The clients are not, you know, kind of the thing out. The way out is digital and direct. Follow people around the internet, shouting your message at them, and eventually they'll buy. You know, kind of, and the strategic stuff is just not being done.
Yeah.
Okay. Strategic stuff. You go to your client and you say, we need to do some brand building. When everyone goes quiet, your voice becomes louder, and the client is going, who are you? Are you the guys who? No. You know, kind of, why should I trust you? Why should I trust you? And if we and if we persist with this obsession with purpose, if we keep on playing in the purpose sandpit as brand advertisers, then eventually the client will go, I don't need you, man. I'm just going to stick with the sales activation stuff and the digital. I'm going to put all my money into that. I'm going to give all my money to Martin Sorrell. I'm going to make sure he's getting me in my numbers. And if brand advertising dies as a result, agencies will die as well.
Right, right. Okay, so you published your version in early March, and this new version's been out for about a month. What's been the reaction to your book?
I was expecting a shitstorm. I really was. You know, kind of. I was going to call it. You'll never. The subhead would have been, you'll never eat lunch in this town again. You know,
yeah. Kind of.
Or the biggest career suicide note in history. I haven't had one negative, the only negative response I've had was from a good friend of mine in the US who has never spoken to me again since him the draft.
Yeah.
So, but I think the US is you're crazy, really. You're so violently polarized now. I fear if the wounds were, how you're going to heal the wounds, but we won't get into that. And I just hope you do, because I love America. I really do. And I hope you're our last best hope. No. Still are.
Yeah. We're recording this on September 28th, and we've got a month and a half of much more craziness to come before an election and beyond that too. So
the response to my book in the UK, good. No, I haven't had one word I haven't had one negative thing. So I'm beginning to surmise that I was wrong when I said that the whole of Adland was a you know, left-leaning progressive bubble, I'm beginning to think that there are a hell of a lot of people from the messages of support that I've had mm-hmm. who are actually tired of having the purpose-driven strategies imposed upon them, and the groupthink that enforces that. Right. You know, kind of, and it does lead me to think that there is a surprisingly small number of people who are careerists who are either careerists or they're committed left-wing progressive activists, you know, kind of who see advertising as a means of expressing their political views or they're careerists. And I think there are more of these who don't want to roll back on their purpose-driven commitments mm-hmm. because, hey man, you know, kind of it's part of their personal brand, you know, it's why they got the bloody job.
So you've had a wonderful career, you've won a lot of awards, you've written several wonderful books. What's next for you?
I don't know.
Is there any more mountains to climb, Steve?
Oh, well, I think I've probably walked up a few hills. I've not necessarily climbed any mountains, Dan. I've climbed over a few walls and whatever, but not mountains. I don't know. It's a weird one. The books that I've written before, how to do better, how to write better copy, how to do better creative work. I thought, and Howard, I thought that they were useful. I thought they were useful to the industry. But this is the only book I've ever promoted, you know, because mm-hmm. I'm vainglorious enough to think that it's actually important. You know, kind of, I'm sorry, you know, kind of, and that's probably is a bit too, you know, kind of audacious or whatever, but I actually, you know, think that it's an important book. And so I'll stick with it, see how far it goes for the next couple of months, and then we'll think about what to do next.
Wonderful. Well, it is a thought-provoking book. I thought some of it was spot on. I took issue with a little bit of it. I think that was probably the reaction a lot of people will have. It is available on Amazon.com here in the U.S. and also Amazon.co in the U.K. It recently became available. I don't know how long it takes to ship. It took me about a week to get my copy. The book, again, is called Can't Sell, Won't Sell, Advertising, Politics, and Culture Wars, Why Advertising Has Stopped Selling and Started Saving the World. Steve Harrison, thank you for your time. It has been wonderful to talk to you. Always a pleasure. And
thank you, Dan. And thanks again. It took a bit of courage to do this.
I don't know about courage. It took a little bit of coordination between us because we are very socially distanced at the moment. You are 6,000 miles away, but I appreciate your time and thank you all for listening to Ad Chatter from AdPulp.com.
Sponsored by Large Mountain in Omaha, Nebraska. Engineered by Dan Goldgeier in Seattle, Washington.